Welcome to the Barbara Schulte Show with host Barbara Schulte and producer Ben Self. The Barbara Schulte Show brings conversations, stories, and tips intended to power up a writer's potential for more success, fun, and the confidence to ride and live with grace, courage, and the grit to never give up.
In this episode, you'll meet Warwick Schiller from Hollister, California. Warwick is passionate about teaching writers in all disciplines to become the best partner possible with their horse. He is in high demand. Warwick's YouTube channel alone has over 20 million views. And it is my honor to call Warwick my friend. He has impacted my life because he not only freely shares his wisdom about horses, but he also openly shares how he continues to grow personally on his journey with both horses and people. Hey, Warwick.
Welcome. Good morning, Bob. Thank you.
How are you, my friend?
I am excellent. How about you?
I'm doing great. So, Warwick, I just want to tell you that you are someone who I admire so much because you're so good at so many things. You're good at training. You're good at horsemanship. You're good at teaching. You're good at being creative. You're good online. And also, I think that you have been, or you are, so unique in your journey, and you're brave and courageous with that. So I know a lot of people listening know who you are, and maybe you'll be introduced to some other people for the first time. So I'd love for you to walk us through a bit of your story and bring us to date about what you do and how you do it.
Well, I'd say, you know, the story's probably not that big a story for quite a long time. Excuse me. I grew up on a 1,200-acre sheep and wheat farm in Australia. My dad rodeo did all, there was only five events at the time. This is before team roping actually came to Australia. And then, you know, after he stopped riding rough stock, he was competing in the timed events, and quarter horses had just been introduced in Australia in the late '60s. And so they started using them for timed events. And so that's how kind of we got introduced to the quarter horses. I probably started riding, I think I was about seven. I'm not exactly sure, but I remember I broke my arm in the steer riding at a rodeo when I was 10 years old. I was in the fifth grade, and I know I'd been riding horses for probably 2 or 3 years before that. That's the only way I can tell how that happened. And you know, rode horses as a kid. We started out in Pony Club in Australia, and then we ended up competing in, like the Western all-around events. You rode one horse and you did every event all day long on them.
I can understand. I did the same.
And, you know, Dad had used to get Western Horseman magazine. And I used to sit there and read those things, you know, cover to cover over and over and over and over again, like almost to the point where you could show me the cover and I could tell you what articles were in it. You know what I mean? So I was always fascinated by the Western lifestyle in the US, really. So, and I always wanted to come over here.
I see. So you came over here, and then what happened?
I came over here in the end of 1990. And so, we're coming from a working class family that, you know, life looks like this. You go to school so you can get a job, then you get married, then you have kids, and then you die. That's kind of how it all goes. And so I was relatively good at math in school. And when I was in high school, I was in the 12th grade, what's called a careers advisor. She said the local banks are recruiting people, you know, come and take the entrance exam. And this is probably partway through what you guys would call your senior year in high school. And I took the exam, and the local bank said, hey, we want to give you a job. And I'm thinking, I'm going to go into high school to get a job anyway, you know. So I took a job in this bank. So I worked for the bank for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, but always wanted to at least come to America and experience it. And I actually wanted to come over here and work for someone to learn how to train reining horses a little bit so I could do it myself at home, really. And I'd met one person in Australia, and they lived here in California, and she had said, hey, if you want to come to America, come and stay at my mum and dad's place and they can kind of hook you up, sort of thing. So I came to the States in late 1990, because at the time in the bank, they would give you what they called a year's leave without pay, which means you could take the year off, you know, if you want to travel or whatever, you know, and then you come back, you could have a job. And so I took them up on that, and I came to the US, and I was here for about a week staying with these people, and we went to Cow Palace, and it was the day the cow horse was on. And, you know, I was interested in the reining, and so we're watching the cow horse, and like, yeah, this is a bit rough and ready. The reining's kind of what I'm interested in. And then they have this big reining class, and there was one guy in this reining class that really stood out above everyone else, and he won the class. And he's this great big fella. And so Tony Amaral was judging that, and the people I was staying with knew Tony, and they said to Tony, do you know anybody who's looking for someone to go to work for him? And he said, yeah, Don Murphy's looking for someone, and that was the big guy that won the class. And so we got Don's number, and I went over and I saw him. I think I went over there a couple of days ago and saw him. He said, yep, you can start Monday. And so I basically had a job right away, and I worked for Don for that year. And when it was time to leave, I was on the porch saying goodbye to Don at his place. And he said, well, if you ever want a job, you know, you want to come back, I'd have you back again. He says, you could do this for a living if you wanted to. And I had never probably considered that. You know, I'm not one of those people who like has had a lot of self-confidence, you know what I mean? Or I don't know if I didn't dream big, but I didn't think big or act big. But, you know, I really didn't have goals in life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew what I was interested in, but I didn't think that, you know, I could do that for a living. So, you know, I'd met who's now my wife, Robin, in the meantime, while I was working for Don that year. And so I went back to Australia, and that whole time I knew Robin, I was chasing her and she was running away like a scalded cat. And it wasn't until I got back to Australia that, you know, we were writing letters back and forth, and her letters actually admitted she kind of missed me chasing her around. So there was that, uh-huh. You know, so there was the job offer from Don and, Robin getting a little bit more interested, and, you know, I decided to come back and work for Don for another 2 years, and then got married and went out on my own.
I see. So you trained reining horses when you went out on your own?
I trained anything that came in the door when I went. Actually, the first year that I went out, I didn't go out on my own. Actually, I took a job working for some people that he was a Scotch bar time stud that they'd got from Jim Dudley, and they had all these young pleasure horses they wanted to train. So that wasn't my passion by any means, but I could do it. And so, I spent that year training pleasure horses. Then when I went out on my own, you know, I'd had some success with the pleasure horses. So when I went out on my own, then I had, you know, people bring me them too, which I didn't necessarily want to do, but I did it. But yeah, I kind of took in a bit of everything. But my in-laws for our wedding present gave me a yearling. And he was a, you know, somewhat performance bred, you know, out of truck and trailer, out of Washington by truck and trailer sort of thing. And so he was a yearling. So I trained him, and he was the first horse I actually had to show. You know, he was the first reiner that I got to show. And so showing him, you know, that got me some more horses and some more horses, and it kind of went on from there. But yeah, he was the first one that I had to, that I got to go show on.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what you do now. How did it evolve? Because I know you do a lot of things now.
How did it evolve? It's funny. I was listening to a Tony Robbins talk podcast, something a couple of years ago. And he's talking about seven things you need to do to be a complete human being or whatever it is, you know. And he listed the first five and he said, now, once you get to there, and then number six, this one's hard. And he said, it's giving, and it's giving with no thought of getting anything back for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to thinking about that, thought, huh. So anyway, this is a bit of a story about how I got to where I am now. Mm-hmm. So when my son was in the first grade, we were traveling all over the country, going to horse shows. And I kind of got to thinking, you know what, if the better you get at this business, the more time you spend away from home. And I'm not sure, you know, we actually homeschooled him that year because we drug him all over the country. And so I thought, you know, maybe this is not what we want to do because it's probably not the best for the kids or the kid. We haven't got one. And later that year, I had a wealthy client of mine offer me a job training horses for them privately. And mm-hmm. so for the next 3 years for them, I bought yearlings, trained them as two-year-olds and sold them as futurity prospects. And so I got to spend, you know, I got to drop my son off at school, go out, ride, pick him up from school, take him back out to the ranch, and he could ride the quad, ATV, and shoot his BB gun. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of hung out all the time. But then they decided they wanted to move to Colorado and live in the snow. And so I'd had a business where we had, you know, 16, 17 horses in full-time training. And I had a young fella work with me for 5 years. And before this job offer came up, I said to him, you know, I've taught you what I can teach you about how to get an average horse to be okay. I said, but I don't have the kind of, you know, I don't have the kind of stock like the big guys are riding. And I said, you really should go to Texas and work for someone who is really competing in, you know, in all the aged events and riding better stock, because, you know, there's one thing being able to make, you know, an okay horse good, but there's a totally different thing being able to make a, you know, make a great one great, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he'd gone to Texas. Well, then I got this job offer. So I called him up. I said, and he'd been there for 6 months. He was working for Del Hendricks. And I called him up and I said, do you want to come back and take over my barn? So I basically gave my business to him and I went over to work for these wealthy people. When they decided they were going to do something else, I thought, well, what do I do now? Do I move back over next to my old place and steal my clients back? You know, like that, that kind of didn't feel right. And so we thought, well, why not? Let's move to Australia. So we bought two studs and took them to Australia, and we're going to be in the breeding business and the training business and all that. And it didn't really work. We're there for 4 years. And, you know, Australia being an island, it's a bit like Hawaii. There's a lot less diseases there, and they don't have the horse flu there. So they don't vaccinate for it. You know, they don't have all the stuff we have, you know, east and western encephalitis, have tetanus. And so right as we got there, and in Australia, when you bring a quarter horse stallion in, you're the new kid on the block and everybody breeds to you the first year, and you recoup some of your investment the first year. Then you've got to kind of wait till those foals are old enough to show before you start getting serious mm-hmm. money. Well, we had an outbreak of EI. So the government shut down, like if wherever your horse was, he couldn't leave. You couldn't take your horse across the road. It was illegal to move a horse from wherever they were. They shut the whole country down for horses for 6 months. And so we could actually collect semen and we could ship it, but vets couldn't go out to people's places to inseminate mares. So we basically lost that first breeding season, and that kind of, you know, set us off on the wrong foot. And so it wasn't much of a success. Anyway, so end of 2010, we decided we're going to come back. And I was on the Australian team for the World Equestrian Games that year. So I came over for that and then had to go back and finish selling up the house and all that sort of stuff. And so when we got back, I'm like, I got to start all over again. And while I was in Australia, we were on the board of Reining Australia, which is the, you know, NRHC there. And they have a big horse expo there called Equitana. And at one of the board meetings, they said, hey, we need someone to do a reining demonstration in Equitana. Well, I was about 8 hours drive from Equitana, but most of the other people are, you know, 36 hours drive from Equitana. So I said, well, I'll, we've got one of the studs was an NRHA open futurity finalist. And so I said, I'll take him down there and, you know, do a bit of promotion for the sport. And Equitana has a 3-day colt starting competition. They called Way of the Horse, you know, taken off Road of the Horse over here. And they contacted me when I was coming down and said, would you like to commentate on Way of the Horse? I'm like, sure. I can't do the introductions. I'm not like that, but I'll be the color commentator and talk about what's happening in the arena. So I did that for 3 days at this horse expo. And there's probably 3,000 or 4,000 people in there every day. Well, after that, so if you think about it, I only did that to help them out. There wasn't a plan for that to be anything. But after that, I had a lot of people call me and say, hey, we really love the way you explain stuff. Would you like to do a clinic for us? I'm like, I don't really do clinics, but okay. And so that's how I started doing clinics. Not because I said, oh, I think I know what I'm talking about and I'm going to do clinics. It was people said, hey, we like the way you explain stuff. So I'd been doing a lot of clinics in Australia while we were there. And when we moved back over here, I had noticed that quite a few people don't understand horses well enough for things to be simple. You know, a lot of the problems people were having with their horses, just not understanding some simple concepts. And so I thought, well, I've got time on my hands. I'll just make some YouTube videos and start talking about some of these simple concepts. This, once again, was not meant to go anywhere. This was just, I've noticed that people struggle with some simple things. And I started making YouTube videos about them. And when you, I don't know if it's the same now, but when you first start making YouTube videos back then, at least, if you don't have a certain number of views on YouTube, they will only let you put up to 10-minute clip on there. You know, they don't want 3 hours of your cat chasing a laser pointer in the hallway or something, you know. And so people started saying, well, we want longer videos. And I had started, you know, I was training horses at the time and I was taking in, you know, some different problem horses of different types. And people said they want longer videos. And so I searched around a way to do that and found this online video hosting platform that was going to charge me to put the videos on there. So I charged people to watch them. And, you know, I was getting, you know, like big scary Andalusians and stuff coming in with problems. And so I started filming them. Like when they first come in, this is what the horse looks like. This is the problem they're having. And I would show the first day, the second day, the third day. I would basically, it was like you were sitting there. You got to watch me work on the horse every day, but I was talking my way through it. And so, yeah, basically what I do these days is clinics and videos, and none of those two things was me saying, yes, I know what I'm doing. I'm gonna do this. It was, it just so happened that that stuff came about from basically volunteering, you might say. And you know, and that wasn't the plan either. And I think it only works that way too. You can't go, yes, Tony Robbins said you've got to give, so I'm going to start giving so I can get something back. I don't think the universe works that way. Like it doesn't. It doesn't compute that way.
So then I think there was another turn in your, or another layer in your evolution where, well, I'll just let you talk about it.
Well, you're a part of this. So, you know, my wife bought a running horse a few years ago, about 6 years ago now, I think. And we got him cheap, but he should have cost about four times what he cost because he could do the hard stuff, but he was just a tense sort of a horse and he kind of spooked at judges' chairs and things like that. So they really couldn't get him shown well. And so I thought, you know, at the time I don't know how many, you know, my YouTube channel has about 27 million views now, but at the time, maybe it had about 15 million views, but I'm, you know, people are listening to what I got to say. I do clinics around the world. The horses come in, they leave better. So obviously I know what I'm talking about. I can fix that horse. And so she bought him and I got him home and I could not, it's not, I couldn't do anything with him, but and like the spooking at the judges' chairs, things like that were fine. But what I discovered about this horse was he carried a level of tension that you couldn't train out of him. You couldn't make him better by exercises and drills and things like that. And where it kind of got in the way with him is like in the reining, he'd be running large, fast circles and while he's running fast, he'd just get tense and he might pop his hind feet together. So in the reining, that's a 1-point penalty for being out of lead. And Robin could go in there and she could mark a 74, but he would pop out of lead four times running fast just because he's tight. And so now she's a 70. And so she could do all the hard stuff. It would just be tiny little things like that. But I could not. I tried working on it and nothing I knew made him better. So I, you know, I stepped away from, I let him be who he is. And I stepped away from trying to make him any different. But I think that kind of got me thinking, well, hell, I thought this stuff works on all horses. Like training works. And it, so I started looking, I guess I started having, you know, articles might pop up on social media, on the internet or whatever, that were normally stuff that I might just skip over. Like that's for them crazy cat ladies with horses, you know what I mean? And really got me thinking more about relationship with horses. And I, lucky enough, I did a clinic in Texas a few years back. This is probably 2017. And this lady had a Mustang in this clinic, and it was a 3-day clinic. And this Mustang is 9 years old, been out of the wild for 6 years. They ride him, he does groundwork, he's fine, except every once in a while he will randomly bolt. And it's out of the blue, like it might be something that yesterday that didn't bother him at all, and today he bolts. And the lady that owned him had him in the clinic, but her trainer was there too, and she's pretty handy, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not, and so I believe, and I said, so what's the trigger? She goes, I can't figure out the trigger. I mean, because bolting is not the problem. It's, you know, it's a symptom of something else. You've got to figure out what causes it. She said, I can't figure out what causes it. It's that random. And so the first day of this clinic, I don't remember. So I have a, at the time I was having a morning group and an afternoon group, 6 in the morning, 6 in the afternoon. This horse is in the morning group. And the first day, I don't even remember him. I can't remember seeing him the first day. So it was pretty non-eventful, whatever the first day was. But the second day during the clinic, the owner, Hannah, she was doing some groundwork and she was just going to walk down his near side and ask him to disengage, just step over behind. And when she went to do that, he blocked her out with his head. He turned his head and blocked her out. And she said, hey, Warwick, can you help me over here? He's kind of blocking me out with his head. What do I do? And normally what I would do if a horse blocked me out, with, if I was in, you know, facing a horse, I was going to walk down his near side and he turned his head to his left, my right, and blocked me out, I would just reach softly under his jaw with my left hand and just move his head over. And now I'm in his left eye, not in his right eye. No, I just walk down that side. But some of this stuff I've been reading really made me think about things. So when he turned his head to block me out, instead of moving his head, I just stepped back to where I was and basically said, hey, I saw your concern. I don't know why that bothers you, but it bothers you. And I'm going to let you know that I see that it bothers you. And then I stood there until he showed me some sign of relaxing again, whether he took a breath, blinked, started to move his ears, one of those things. And then I tried to walk down there again and he turned his head and said no. So I just stepped back and waited till he was relaxed again. And I kept trying that for probably about 10 minutes. And after about 10 minutes, he lets me walk down beside him. I'm like, okay, I don't know why I'm now, maybe it's the disengaging he doesn't like. He doesn't think I'm going to disengage him now. So I ask him to step over behind, which he does perfectly well. He's trained perfectly well. And I thought, mm-hmm. Now I'm going to walk back to the front of him and see if he lets me walk down the side. If he doesn't let me walk down the side, he doesn't like the disengaging. Maybe his hocks hurt. Maybe, I don't know. So I go back to the front and I walk down the side and he lets me and I disengage him and I go back to the front and I walk down the side and I disengage him and I do it 5 or 6 times and he's not blocking me out anymore. And so I hand him back to Hannah, the owner, and I said, I don't know what I just did, but he's not doing it anymore. And she said, what do you want me to do? And I said, just hang on to the lead rope. Just hang with him for a bit. Let him settle with that. And I went off to help someone else. And about 10 minutes later, there's this collective from everybody in the clinic. And we turn and look, and this horse has just buckled at the knees, dropped to his belly, had a big roll, got up, dropped to his knees, and fallen asleep, like face down on his belly. You know, his nose is in the dirt. He's snoring little dust clouds. And I said to Hannah, is that normal? Because if it's normal, it's not a big deal. And she said, I've seen him lay down once in 6 years.
Oh, wow.
And the one time he was laying down, he saw me from a distance and he jumped up. But this horse never lays down. And this was about 10:30 and he was sound asleep there till lunchtime, till the second group was going to come in. We had to wake him up for the second group to come in. She put him away. She brought him back in the next morning. And she said, what do you want me to do? And I said, just hang on him, see what happens. And after about 20 minutes, boom, down he went again and slept for 4 hours. The microphone's on, horses under saddle, cantering past him, the whole bit. We had to wake him up again for the second group to come.
Wow.
Anyway, so I knew something had happened and I wasn't sure what had happened, but that was quite a change in that horse. And I really hadn't I hadn't trained him. You know, I didn't really do anything. And I came home and started researching horse habits of sleep. I mean, sleep habits of horses, sorry. And, you know, I knew horses sleep standing up or laying down. But what I didn't realize is when they sleep standing up, it's only a light sleep. And in order to get that REM sleep, that deep restorative sleep we need, they have to lay down. And they have to lay down get about 30 minutes a day for their nervous system to be properly regulated. Mm. And it doesn't have to be all at once. It might be 10 here, 10 there, and 10 there, but they have to be able to do it. And we don't know with horses, but with humans, if they don't get enough REM sleep, they are irritable or anxious. But anyway, long story short, that was 4 years ago. This horse has not bolted once since that day.
Oh, wow.
And what I realized was all I did with him was communicate my awareness of his concern. That's it. I didn't train him to do anything. I didn't I asked him to disengage just as a test, but I didn't train him to do anything. And it really got me thinking, huh. So then I really started messing with this connection thing with horses, like being present with them and just noticing all the little things. You know, there's an old Ray Hunt saying that says they know when you know and they know when you don't. And I used to think that saying meant they know when you know what you're talking about and they know when you don't know what you're talking about. You know, they can tell a greenhorn from a mile away sort of thing. But after this has happened with the Mustang and I'd started messing with it at clinics, I read an article by someone who used to spend a lot of time with Ray Hunt, and I forget who it was, but he said, when you're around your horse, you need to be aware of what his ears are doing, what his eyes are doing, what his muzzle's doing, what his breathing's doing, what his back's doing, what his neck's doing, what his tail's doing. Is it down? Is it clamped? Is it up? Is it loose? And you need to be aware of all those things. You need to know those things because they know when you know and they know when you don't. So they know when you know those things. They know when you are present. What I've started to realize is horses communicate all these little things, even smaller than what the Mustang did. And if you can let them know you see them, you're letting them know you're present. Well, think about in a herd, what gives horses a feeling of safety in the herd? It's not the physicality of the herd. It's not like, oh yeah, three members of the herd have black suits and a little earpiece in their ear and dark glasses and a Glock. And if anybody shows up, they're going to shoot them. You know, it's not the physicality of the herd. It's the awareness of the group awareness of the herd is what makes them feel safe, because I don't have to look 360 degrees for danger. And what I've started finding out is if you can just be present when you're around horses and communicate that you're aware of little things, it's a complete game changer. So that had been going on for a while. I'd been messing with that a bit. And then I was at a horse expo in Madison, Wisconsin. And some of those horse expos, they have you do like a demo in the arena, but sometimes they have you do a speech, you know, a lecture hall type talk. And I have I've had for a number of years now a go-to one of those. And I call it Everything I Learned in Life I've Learned About Horses. And I talk about, you know, different life lessons I've learned from horses that carry over to every other part of my life. And I think the Mustang must have been earlier that year, because the last time I did this talk, it wasn't the same talk. But so I met you, Barb, that morning. Your booth was just down from mine. You're with Sandy Collier, and I'd heard of you, but never met you. So we said hi. And so then I go off to do this talk. Well, I go up and do this talk. And in this talk, something had changed in me, but I, in a room of probably 150 people, maybe, I spat out some stuff that I'd probably never spat out before to probably anybody. And here I am, you know, telling a room of 100 and something strangers. Funny enough, when I first walked in there, Sandy Collier came in and sat in the front row. Oh, my bloody hell. Anyway, I got done with that talk and I was going back.
Wait, Warwick. What did you spit out that you had never spit out before.
Oh,
had
never spit out. I don't know. I can't remember now.
Uh-huh.
But it was just, I was just vulnerable about something or other that I hadn't, mm-hmm. I forget what it was. Mm-hmm. Okay. But then I got done with that and I was going back to my booth and I walked past your booth and you said, hey, how did the talk go? And I said, I feel like I've been run over by a truck. I'm exhausted. And you said, why? And I'm like, oh, because I spat out some stuff I probably haven't ever spat out before. And it just like, it just drained me, especially to that many people. And you said something about vulnerability and some lady named Brené Brown who I'd never heard of. And so I came home from that thing and I looked up this Brené Brown lady that I'd never heard of. And I got some of her audiobooks and I started listening to one of her audiobooks. And at one point in time, one of these audiobooks, she said, you cannot selectively suppress your emotions. If you suppress the lower emotions like fear and grief, things like that, you automatically suppress the higher emotions like joy and things like that. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I mean, I know, you know, a male of my generation growing up in Australia, boys don't cry, boys don't show fear. Doesn't mean you don't have it, but you're just not allowed to tell anybody about it. And I thought, I know that's there, but I never thought about the other side of it. I never thought about, I wonder, could I experience more joy in my life? Never gave that a thought. So I'd met a lady at that horse expo who is a therapist. And so I messaged her and I said, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to work on maybe trying to work through this stuff. What should I do? And she said, I would go to a therapist who specializes in something called dialectical behavior therapy, which was originally started for highly suicidal adults, but now they use it for anybody with any emotional regulation issues. And so I went along, found a therapist. And my first session with her, I told her what I wanted to do. And she said, oh, yeah, this will be easy. She said, we also have group therapy at night once a week, but you won't need to do that one. Anyway, after about 3 months of going and seeing this lady once a week and not getting anywhere, she said, you probably should do the group therapy too, you know. And so I did that too. And I did the whole thing for a year and I didn't get anywhere. That therapy did not do a thing for the problem I was going there for, because what I realized is you have to have some emotions for that to work. And so I figured out that I was really emotionally shut down. And what's funny is the horse that Robin had bought was shut down. And you know, so I had a shut down horse kind of lead me to figure out how shut down I was. But what was really interesting, you know, I didn't get any help with the emotion stuff, but I did learn some amazing stuff at that group therapy. We used to have homework once a week and they'd have you do different homeworks. A lot of them were mindfulness practices, but one week they said, okay, so this week's all about judgment. So right now, they said, Warwick, I want you to identify three objects in the room. And I'm like, okay, well, that's a chair, that's a couch, and that's a funny-looking lamp over there. And she goes, whoa, stop. That is not a funny-looking lamp. You judged it a funny-looking lamp, but it's a lamp. And I'm like, oh. Mm-hmm. And so your homework for this week is to count your judgmental thoughts. So get one of those little clickers like a bus conductor might have or a doorman at a nightclub or something. Or get some pebbles, put them in your pocket. And when you have a judgmental thought, take it out, pebble out of that pocket and put it over the other side, or click your clicker, whichever you got. And I thought, well, I'm only going to have about three judgmental thoughts a day. So I'll just get three pebbles and put them in my pocket. And by the end of the day, I'll have, you know, the three will go from one side to the other. Well, the next morning I wake up and I had 21 before breakfast. And what I realized was, when you start counting your judgmental thoughts, not only do you become aware of how many you have, you become aware of how many you have about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that really tied into the Brené Brown stuff I was reading. You know, as you know, Brené Brown's a shame researcher, but she says the difference between guilt and shame is guilt is a focus on your actions. Shame is a focus on self. So, you know, if you do something stupid, shame would be, oh, I am so stupid. Whereas if you feel guilt about it, you go, oh, I did something stupid, which means I have a chance next time to rectify that. I can do it differently. Mm-hmm. But when you have that self-talk to where you're like, oh, you're so stupid, mm-hmm. it kind of, you know, it gets stuck inside you. It becomes a part of who you are. And that becomes a part of your, and this leads back to horses, that becomes a part of your energy. And that energy is what you bring to your interaction with a horse. And so, you know, I'd started, I think somewhere in here, I'd started a meditation practice and different things like that. But, and that whole year was 2018. And we actually, I took the year off from doing clinics that year because we were going to do the World Equestrian Games that year. And I was going to be gone, you know, I need to be home riding the horses all the time. I couldn't just be gone and come back and go to a show. And so I wasn't traveling all that year. And when I went back to traveling at the start of 2019, first airport I get to, I'm walking along through the airport and, you know, I'm walking from security to my gate and there's all these people walking past me and I'm a people watcher. You know, I think everybody people watches in airports, but what I realize now, being aware of judgmental thoughts, is I'm not a people watcher. I'm a people judger. Every mm-hmm. person that walked past me, I was judging them. You know, too many clothes, not enough clothes, too many tats, you know, do you mm-hmm. even own a comb? Get a haircut, you know, all this judgment. And so I realized I was doing it. And so then I went, okay, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to look everybody that's walking the other way. I'm going to look them in the eye, give them a little eye smile. And I'm going to think to myself, may you be happy. And so I'm walking along, may you be happy, may you be happy, may you be happy, may you be happy, may you be happy. I get to my gate and there is a warm, light, joyous feeling inside me that is not normally there. And I'm like, huh. And then I realize there normally is this dark, heavy feeling that's so normal, I don't even notice it's dark or it's heavy because it's, you know, it's colorless because it's your normal. And also I felt completely different. Then I realized, huh, just walking through an airport and, you know, judging people, all that judgment, just, you know, it's this dark sort of a thing. So this relates to the World Equestrian Games because during the year leading up to the World Equestrian Games, we enlisted a friend of ours from New Zealand named Jane Pike. And Jane Pike is an equestrian mindset coach, kind of similar to you. And we had, so we did, you know, Zoom calls with Jane, talked about different things. And at one point in time, Jane had us, she gave us some questions to answer. And we answered them to her over a Zoom call. She wrote them down. And then she made us an audio to listen to. And one for Robin, one for I, because Robin was representing Australia in the running as well. And so she gives this audio to listen to, and she said, you have to listen to it with stereo headphones. I'm like, okay. So I start listening to this audio, and Jane is, you know, I can hear Jane in both ears. She's chatting away, talking about stuff. And about 10 minutes in, one Jane keeps talking, and the other Jane goes away, and a different Jane comes back there. So I've got these two conversations going on in my head. And it was a bit confusing. You can kind of listen to one or the other, or sometimes you just drift off and don't listen to any of them. And she said, you just got to listen to this, you know, at least once a week, a couple of times a week if you can. So then we come to the World Equestrian Games. And, you know, you don't have to use the horse you're qualified for the World Equestrian Games. But we decided we were going to go with our horses, even though they're not superstar horses, because we know them. And, you know, the drug rules that the FEI level is just crazy. You got to be careful what fly spray you put on horses. And so we knew we were going to have complete control of them and all that. So when we got to the World Equestrian Games, our team coach, what they call a chef d'equipe in FEI stuff, he said, so what do you think you and Robin can do? Like, what do you think you can mark on these horses? And I'm like, you know, probably 217 and a half will pull us up. If we're in the right place, horse is in the right place, it all happens all at the same time, that'll probably pull us up. Because Rodney's trying to figure out if we might be in contention for a team medal, because the other two team members we have as superstars, so they're going to mark 223 or 4 or something, you know. And so the first round of competition is the team round of competition. All your scores added up, and that's where the team medals are awarded. So we go and compete. I'm a 217, Robin's a 218. But what was weird about the experience was, here's the world of question games. Like, my ass cheeks are supposed to be so clamped together, it's not funny. And it's the most relaxed I've ever been showing at any show ever. I was in the zone. Everything was quiet. Everything was slow. I was focused. It was really unlike any experience I'd had showing before. And they have 20 horses in the individual finals. The top 15 go straight to the individual finals from that first round, from the team round. And then the next 20, so places 16 to 35, go into semifinals, and the top five of those go back. And so Robin and I both make the semifinals, which we never expected to do. And so we go in the semifinals. I'm a 220.
Wow.
And Robin's a 220 and a half.
Awesome.
And once again, it was like, I have not ever experienced competing like that before. Everything was clear. I mean, I was in the zone. It was just an experience I hadn't had before. Mm-hmm. And so afterwards, I got to thinking about, well, what was different about it? And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me, holy cow, it wasn't necessarily what was there, it what wasn't there. And right then, I realized that every time I've shown a horse, even though I know what I'm capable of and what they're capable of, and I'm not going to show a horse if he's not ready to show, but I realized that, holy cow, I just realized that every time I've shown a horse, in the back of my mind, there's been this little subconscious thing going, who do you think you are? You suck. You're not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Subconsciously. Consciously, you think about, you know what you're doing. And I realized, that wasn't there. And that was the difference. And it turned out that thing Jane gave us was a hypnosis tape. And so, you're consciously listening to one of those voices. Well, your subconscious apparently takes the other one in. And so it's kind of the same thing as the airport thing. When you've got that negative loop going, it affects you in ways you really have no clue it's affecting you, because it's a lot of it's subconscious. And I'm pretty sure the stuff you've learned from Jim, and I think that deals a lot of that too. But it was just a big eye opener for me, not just the World of Question Games experience, but like the airport experience. But since I've started doing things like that differently, like at either horse expos or clinics, someone's got a horse on the ground, it's a warm blood and it's bouncing all over the place and it's rearing up and it's anxious and it can't stand still, and I'll say, bring him over here and I'll see what I can do with him. And in the past, I used to do something with them, but a lot of times these days, people bring the horse over and hand the lead rope to me, and the horse comes up, hey, how's it going? And all that anxiety goes out of them. And it's not something that I'm doing to the horse. It's who I am these days, but none of that stuff came from the horse training thing. And I think a lot of it has to do with judgment. Like if someone leads a big warm blood that's bouncing up and down and trying to bite their lead rope and try to bite the person, and as they're coming towards me, I'm thinking, oh, you rotten piece of crap, I'm going to, there's an energy to that. Whereas these days I'm like, hey, how's it going? And so, yeah, that's been a huge change. So these days, I share these stories with people a lot because, it's amazed me the change with the things I've been doing. And, I used to be able to help a majority of the people, say, at clinics. But there were some people I couldn't help in the past. I used to think, you need to get a cat, preferably an outside cat. You know what I mean? Because I thought they're not good with horses. But what I've realized is, the people I used to think were not good with horses are actually not good with themselves. They're not in their own body. They're in their head. They've got a story attached to what's going on. And so these days I kind of share my journey about some of that stuff because it helps people understand that what the you know, the self-talk that we, the energy we have, the self-talk we bring, all that stuff we bring to the party is a huge part of getting along with, well, any sentient being, but, you know, horses. Mm-hmm. Is that enough information?
I love that. It was perfectly, of course, articulated. So how do you work on yourself, Warwick? How do you, like, what do you do now? Or I think the
working on yourself starts out with, well, for me, is figuring out how you got to be the way you are, and finding out that that's not the real you, that that's from things that happened to you over the years. And so, and then you figure out that all the self-judgment you've had about all the things you don't like about yourself are not really your fault in the first place. You didn't elect to end up that way. So then you start out, you can kind of forgive yourself for that. For me, you know, I have always been kind of in freeze mode, you know, from, you know, male in my generation grew up in Australia, you're supposed to be tough and all this stuff. And I've never really had access to my body, really, like explosive energy, strength, that sort of thing. And I've always judged myself poorly for it and just thought I was whatever, you know. But then as I started seeing different therapists and stuff and talking about different things and started really looking into, you know, the nervous system, trauma, all that sort of stuff, I found out that in the first, so there's a doctor named Dr. Bruce Perry. He wrote a really good book with Oprah Winfrey called What Happened to You? And it's almost like Oprah interviews him, he answers and stuff. But he talks about how a child could have a perfectly good first four months of their life, that very early formative stage, perfectly good, and then could have all sorts of trauma for the next 16, 17 years. And they could be pretty normal. You could have a child have a traumatic first 4 months of their life and then a perfectly good 16, 17 years, and they're in a much worse place than the person who lived through all these traumatic experiences. Well, I started investigating stuff and found out from mum that I knew I had pneumonia a lot when I was a kid, but I had my first bout of pneumonia was when I was 3 months old. And so I spent, you know, a week in a hospital bed, just basically getting fed and that's it, you know, none of the nurturing and stuff that you should have at that point in time. And so you're in a very stressful situation, and a three-month-old doesn't have access to fight or flight. You know, you can't run, you can't swing your arms, you can't do anything. So the nervous system flips into freeze mode. And so that's, and then I had another bout of pneumonia when I was about four or something, and then later on too. But when I was 11 months old as well, I had another bout, was back in hospital for a week or so. And then, but anyway, I found out that things like that earlier on, you know, like, so the first non-regulated nervous system my body knew was freeze.
Hmm.
And so it's always been there. And what I think it tends to do to you, it tends to put you in your head. When I was a kid, if I was going to throw a rock at a tree or something or other, the rock always missed the tree. You know, I've never felt that connected to my body. And so I'm not athletic. That's just a judgment, but you know, and so unraveling that, and I think not wanting to be in my body, you know, like I was wired to just go into my head, I've not tended to push through things that are painful. Okay. My body doesn't like pain. Well, I don't like pain because I think I've discovered that if something hurts, I have to be in my body. And I've, you know, been in my head forever. So what I've started doing, you know, the last few years is going out of my way to do things, not necessarily that hurt, but like, I started taking cold showers here a few years ago. And then for the last year or so, I've been taking ice baths. So I've got a chest freezer in my garage that's full of water. Then you plug it and unplug it to keep the temperature, you know, like between 43 and 48 degrees. And I haven't done it for a while, but for a while there, I was doing regular ice baths a lot. The thing about ice baths is you cannot be in your head and be in an ice bath. You know you're in an ice bath. And the other thing is it's a mental struggle to get in. Like your brain goes, no, let's not do it today. And you're like, yes, we're going to do it. No, you're not. Yeah, we are. No. So pushing myself through mental things like that. And then when you get in, then you've got to struggle to not go into panic mode. You've got to make sure you have a lot longer out breath than in breath to keep you in the parasympathetic nervous system. Because as soon as you start doing that, then it's really cold. And the other thing about ice baths too is it's a lesson in acceptance. Because if you reject the cold, if you're in there like, I don't like this, oh my God, it's cold. It hurts. Whereas if you can just, accept it. And it's kind of a bit like working with horses. Like, you know, I did a clinic on the weekend and there was this off the track thoroughbred there that's had a bit of a troubled past. But this horse will rear up and rear up and rear up. And a lot of people are like, whoa. And I'm like, she's just standing still. She's standing still on two legs. There's no reason to get all concerned about it. Like, don't judge it. It's like she's over there and she's standing up. I'm like, well, have fun with that, sunshine, you know. It's just an acceptance of what's happening instead of a rejection of what's happening. I had a meditation. You asked, what do you do? I had a meditation practice for quite a long time. I have fallen away from that, and I know I've got to get back into it. The ice baths, and I have started working out, and that's something that my body doesn't like to do because it doesn't like to do those sorts of things. I actually went to a group of psychiatrists in the US called the Amen Clinic. You ever heard of the Amen Clinic? What they do is you go along there, and the first thing they do is take a spec scan of your brain. They do two spec scans, one day, one the next day. So they do that and the first one is when your brain's active, they have you do these thinking puzzles while they're scanning your brain. And the next one you kind of relax. So they get a scan of your brain when it's thinking, when it's relaxed. And probably a year ago, I had a neurotransmitter test done. And the results came back. They said, you're running on empty. You have no dopamine, no serotonin, no norepinephrine. You there's nothing going on in you. And so I've been on quite a few supplements for the last year or so trying to balance that. But then I went and did this spec scan the other day. And when the results came back, they're like, oh, yeah, you have chronic changes to your limbic system. And so they basically diagnosed chronic PTSD, chronic depression, and some sort of TBI stuff. You know, I mean, I've been whacked in the head a few times and knocked out a little bit. Not that I've had bad head injuries, but and they suggested changing a number of the supplements I'm taking. Try to get my serotonin levels. So, you know, I'm trying to, you know, I've been working on a lot of different ways, you know. I've stopped drinking caffeine, things like that, you know. But it's, and I'm starting to feel a difference, you know. Starting to feel a difference. And that's why I've been able to start working out now. Like, because I have had, like, you know, what I discovered through this therapy stuff that I've probably been depressed all my life and not known it because it was my normal. You know, some people go, hey, I need to go see somebody because I don't feel like I used to. And they go, oh, yeah, you now have depression. I've had it, you know, I've been blah for forever. My life's been pretty gray most of my life. So that's my normal. But it's kind of like when I walked to the gate at the airport, when I stopped judging people and started, you know, sending positive thoughts to them, whoa, I feel completely different. And now I can tell the difference between this and what used to be my normal. So, There's a fair bit to it.
So you said earlier you were talking about letting a horse see you, or that you let a horse know you see them, which is really what sounds like you've been doing a lot with yourself. You've been noticing yourself and doing different things. But with a horse, how, if people, if someone wanted to understand what you do to let a horse know that you see them, what would you say?
Well, I'll just give you a few examples. You know, last year I did a clinic and there was a lady at this clinic said, "My horse hates men." You've all heard that one before. "My horse hates men." She was, I think it was a little Andalusian looking sort of a horse, and it had been a charro horse. So probably had some, you know, less than optimal situations with humans. But she said, "My horse hates men." And she told me that before the clinic started. And when I walked in the arena, that horse was on the other side of the arena. She's on the ground. The lady's standing beside the horse. And so I was aware of that horse from, you know, probably 80 foot wide an arena. And I walked in the arena and I started slowly walking across the arena towards that horse. And I've only gone about 3 feet inside the gate when that horse kind of looked at me and had a bit of a snort like that. And I stopped and I stepped backwards from 80 feet away. And then when that horse kind of started to relax a bit, I started to walk a bit closer. And anytime that horse either had a bit of a snort or kind of looked away like, "Oh, I think I'm going to leave," I stopped and stepped back and waited for this horse to reset itself. And I eventually got all the way up to him and said, "Hey, how's it going?" And had a bit of a scratch, you know. And I was talking to the lady about, you know, for me, that's very important, is to notice when they become aware of you and let them know you notice that instant. Anyway, then I went off and helped. I said, "Just hang out here for a minute." I went off and helped somebody else. And then I was walking down the arena and I'm probably 60 feet from that horse. And he looks at me, pricks his ears, and starts marching forward and dragging the lady behind him like a dog on a leash. My. And marches all the way up to me and says, "Hey, how's it going?" Now, this is a horse that supposedly hates men. And the only thing I did was let him know I was aware of his concern. And luckily, she had told me ahead of time that he hates men. Otherwise, I might have walked halfway across the arena and been talking to somebody else and not been really aware of that. Little things like that. I mean, there's a million little things you can do, but a lot of it has to do with just approaching a horse. And it's not about right, wrong, good, bad, training, yes, no, that sort of thing. If I'm approaching a horse and their expression changes, good or bad, they might prick their ears and look at me, or they might turn their eyes slightly away like, "Oh God, I don't like this guy." It doesn't matter. As soon as something changes, I'll just pause and then start going again. And as soon as something else changes, I'll pause and I'll just do little things like that. And it's amazing the difference it makes. And some of this stuff I got from this lady from Washington State named Elsa Sinclair. You ever heard of Elsa Sinclair? She made an independent movie a few years ago called Taming Wild. And she set herself a year to get a Mustang, unhandled Mustang, and she was going to train it with no tools. No halters, no ropes, no flags, no whips, no tarps, no saddles, no saddle pads, no bridle, no round pen. So no small area where you can put pressure on them until they look at you and then you can back it. None of that. And she calls it freedom-based training. But in the end, she got to this horse where she could ride it around bareback and bridleless. And there was, and it's the very first thing she does from a distance is communicate their changes in focus. It doesn't have to be to do with her. You know, she might stand at a long distance to a horse, and every time their focus changes, she moves a little bit. Like she, you know, think about a big clock around a horse, you know, like a big circle around a horse. If she's at 9 o'clock and the horse is eating and then it picks its head up and looks at something, she might move to 8:30. It doesn't necessarily have to be looking at her, but she times her movements every time they change focus. And that's kind of how she communicates that she's aware of their focus. Another huge part of that is being able to be present too. So you have to be there and not thinking about doing the groceries, picking up the kids from school, what are you going to do next? You've got to be in the moment. And for me, having meditation practice really helped with that because I was like ping, 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 ping when I first started trying to do that. But you can do it under saddle too. I just had I had a lady at a clinic in Washington just last weekend, and she's a cutter. She had this cute little metallic cat filly there, but she says she's really stiff. like doesn't like if she's riding in a little like Lopen Hackamore and you pick up one rein and she just doesn't really hard to pull her head around sort of thing. And so what I did is I said, well, I'm not going to work on the stiff part. I'm going to work on the reason why this she's stiff. So I hopped on and I just slid my hand down one rein and held my hand out to the side. And I watched her ears and her ears were pricked on something she was looking at, you know. Now, I didn't pull hard. I've just picked up a little feel in that rope and I waited. And when the ear on that side flicked towards me, I let go. And I sat there doing that and did that for about 10 minutes until I could slide my hand down that rein. And as I did, that ear flicked. So instead of her ignoring me, she was paying attention because I was paying attention. And then once that ear would flick, as I went to slide my hand down the rein, I said, and now she should bend. And so I just slid my hand down the rein. The ear came and the nose came and she was as soft could be. Mm. But I didn't work on the physical part first. I worked on communicating about the mental part. You know, I had a mule at a clinic in Arizona this year that was had a lot of separation anxiety from the horses back at the barn. And this mule, you know, the lady's riding around and it just looks like you're wrestling a bear because this mule's trying to go back to the corner of the arena closest to where that barn was. And I said, let me hop on. So I hopped on and I just turned the reins loose and that mule just beelined for that corner and stood in the corner with her big ears up over the fence. And so I did the same thing. I would just pick up on one rein and wait for that ear to flick. And initially, I might sit there for 10 minutes before the ear moved slightly and then I'd let go. But after a while, when I could get the ear to flick quite easily, then I would actually ask her to turn and start going where I wanted to go instead of where she wanted to go. And then by the time I put the owner back on, I said, just hop on and ask her to walk and see where she walks to. And the mule didn't go to that corner. She actually walked down the long side of the arena, completely away from there. And she was walking along and her ears were doing that mule floppy ear thing. And the lady looked at me and she said, this is amazing because this horse's ears never flop in the arena. It's only when she's out on the trail and she's happy to be going somewhere that those ears flop. Normally they're not moving like that. And here we are in an arena and she was walking with a crisp walk instead of dragging her toes sort of thing. Well, the only thing I did with that was just communicating my awareness of where her thoughts were. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was doing something physical to ask for that ear flick thing. Now with the horse that hates men, I didn't ask for anything. I just walked and when that horse went, ooh, you're coming too close, I said, yes, I pick up on your vibe. I get that. And I stop and step back. And for me these days, it's when you can get this bit, everything else becomes so simple because, you know, there's no brace in their body anymore because the brace is actually in their mind. And so these days it's more about even asking for something under saddle, like say to go forward, when I first start asking, I'm going to stop asking when they tell me they're aware of my ask. Like let's say they were sitting there with the ears pricked and I ask a horse to go and its ear flicks towards me, I'll stop asking to go. And I'll do that 3 or 4 times. Then I will actually expect the physical response after that. And it's pretty crazy, but it's all about connection, and that connection is all about being present without judgment. You got to be, you know, like if I ask a horse to go forward, it's not like I'm going to go down there, because that's what I want to do. But the first thing I'm going to do is get the connection. I got to communicate. Hey, I'm aware of you. I'm aware of your awareness of me, and it almost gets to where you're communicating your awareness of their awareness of your awareness of their awareness, sort of thing. But it's, you know, you've got to, yeah, like I said, you've got to be present and you've got to be present without judgment, I think, in order for this stuff to work. And I think that's a practice that affects all parts of your life, and you can practice it in other parts of your life, and it helps with your horses, and you practice it with your horses and it helps with other parts of your life too. But that's really where I think that's the holy grail, the ability to let your horse say no is a big thing. You know, I think it was Leslie Desmond on the podcast, and she said, what good, and this is paraphrasing because I'm not going to get it right, she was more profound, but something like, what good is a yes if they're not allowed to say no? What's the value of a yes if they're not allowed to say no? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's not that they can say no forever, but if you ask them to do something that concerns them, they say, oh, that concerns me. Instead of trying to get the right answer, first thing I'm going to do is say, hey, I see your concern. Mm-hmm. It's about staying below threshold, really. Like, and it's just been a bit of a game changer. And I think the big game changer with that too is, in order to help other people do it, I have to help them change their mindset about what's going on. And especially a horse being able to say no. That's really hard for a lot of people because I'm supposed to win. You can't let them win. But yeah, I think it helps with a lot more than there's a lot more to it than the horse training stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was my next question. How do you teach that to people?
As I saw a sign in a Western store once, it said the best sermons are lived, not preached. And so, you know, a lot of times at clinics, I will, you know, someone's having trouble with their horse and I will take a hold of the horse and then I will show them the difference, just like the horse that hates men. Once you see that, your mind kind of goes, mind blown, like that horse hates men and was snorting from 80 feet away, and then half an hour later it marches 60 feet to come up and say hi. Like, that's changes like that in horses. That's probably the best way to get people to do that, is let them see things like that. So, you know, luckily at clinics there's always a lot of different types of horses, and I always try to find one that and it might be behavioral. You know, like me, the mice horse might be like, say, the one that hates men, or it might be like the little metallic cat mare on the weekend that she's just stiff. And instead of trying to get a physical response, I just picked up and waited for that ear to flick. And when the ear flicked, I let go. And after a while, she was butter soft there. You know, it's and she said, you know, I tend to want to like put my cow side leg on and bump right there. I said, well, you could. And she will respond to that. But I really think the reason she's not responding to your rein is not because she doesn't know how to respond to the rein. She's just kind of like, I'm kind of sick of your stuff. You know, I'd rather look off over there. But once I communicated to her that I was that aware, and especially aware of her changing thoughts, when I picked up on the rein, the thought came, but the nose came. And when you do things like that, things tend to be a lot more biomechanically correct from a horse biomechanics standpoint. You know, you can pull their head around, their nose will come, but their ears get uneven, and now their weight's on their outside front foot instead of their inside hind foot. Whereas if you pick up and they offer it to you, all the right muscles work, and you know, they're reaching around towards you instead of leaning away from you. So it just for me, I'm not a terribly technical rider or a strong rider. Like, I don't tend to make horses do things or ride them through things. Some people can. I'm not really interested in that sort of thing. And I found setting it up to where the horse decides to do it, that, you know, I can't make their muscles work any better than they decide to. But a lot of this stuff, really, if you think about a lot of times, say with groundwork, with horsemanship and groundwork, and if a horse is, you know, distracted or whatever, you move their feet. That's a big thing. And a lot of times, like, let's say a horse is concerned about something and they kind of want to run around a little bit, and you move their feet. That's a little bit like the parenting style that was around in my age, which was stop crying or give you something to cry about, you know, where the child has got a genuine concern about something, and the parent says, I don't want to hear your concern, and if you keep it up, I will do something more concerning to you than the thing that concerns you. And that is supposed to be your support system right there. And so when you get that sort of thing, it makes you feel alone. A lot of times with horses, I think this is the case too. Like, a horse might be uptight or whatever and worried about stuff, and instead of having someone that go, yeah, I get you, there's someone like, don't show me that, or I'll do this to you. And it's, I tell you what, that works very well for obedience. I was a very obedient child, you know, and so were all the other kids in my, it's not just my parents, I'm not saying they did anything wrong. They did what everybody else was doing at the time too. But you know, that whole, I don't know if you're into polyvagal theory, but that whole social engagement system, you know, when any mammal starts to get concerned, the first thing they do is look for a friend. And if no friend's available, then it's fight, flight, and then eventually it's freeze if you have to. Well, a lot of times we, in our training mindset, the horse gets uptight, and instead of offering them friendship, we start training on them, and now they're in flight mode. And it's, I think really studying, you know, going to therapists and just reading books about psychology and things like that, and the mammalian nervous system, and like I said, polyvagal theory, all this stuff's really helped me kind of look at some of the horsemanship stuff a little bit different and experiment with it and figure out, you know what, it actually works. So yeah, it's been a fun journey.
So Warwick, how do you spend your time, and what do you most love? Because you do a lot of different things.
Well, you know, that's a good question, and it's one of those one of those things about the most love thing. I really love teaching. I really love seeing people kind of get it and go, oh, yeah, that's a lot more simple than I thought it was. So I really like imparting that. You know, when I was at that, I had a clinic in Washington on the weekend, and, you know, I have 12 horses and riders in the clinics, but we have, you know, unlimited spectators. So many people as they wanted can come. And we had about, 150 people there that the first day of that clinic. But one day, one point in time, I said, okay, just going to run to the restroom. I run over to the restroom, and on the way to the restroom, there's a lady at who's watching the clinic. She's coming back from the restroom, and she walked past. She goes, "Oh my God, you're just brilliant." And I went in. I went in the arena and turned the mic back on, because you got to turn the mic off before you go to the restroom. And I said, I want to talk to you guys about something. A lady just passed me. She says, "Oh my God, you're brilliant." I said, "What I hope you guys are getting is this is not about. It's just a mindset. If you can have the right outlook on this stuff." It's easy. It's not brilliant. It's just like, oh, yeah, that's kind of common sense if you have a certain outlook. But it's getting rid of all that dogma that we've grown up with, that you got them, you know, you can't let the horse win and yada, yada, move their feet and all that sort of stuff is what the change is. But so I like to teach people. I like to see them get it. But that's the good side of that. But I think the shadow side of that is not having. And this is, you know, I spend a fair bit of time on engaging on social media, and I do that kind of to help people too, but I've realized there's a bit of a shadow side to that, whereas I don't get much, that neurotransmitter tested, I don't have much dopamine, okay? And, but when you get that feedback from other people, you get some dopamine out of that. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, because I've got to make sure that I'm not doing it for the wrong reason. You know what I mean? I'm not, because it can become a little bit addictive I don't want to say adulation, but that, you know, that positive feedback from other people, and it's a great feeling, but you got to make sure that you're not just doing it for that. And, you know, and I struggle, you know, I struggle with, you know, I have a bit of a social media addiction. And so I do various things to limit that. Like we have on our computers in the house, we have a news feed blocker on Facebook, which means I can go on Facebook, but the news feed doesn't pop up. So I can't get stuck there scrolling endlessly for hours, because Facebook is very good at setting things up. So the right lights go off and you get this dopamine hit. And if, you know, if your dopamine is well regulated, you probably don't have that problem. But, you know, I have a bit of an addictive personality. Luckily, I don't think I wouldn't say I haven't struggled with addiction. I just haven't struggled with addiction of anything that people would think was a problem, you know. But reading one of those Brené Brown books, she said, you know, she was talking about numbing behaviors, you know, whether it's heroin or it's Facebook, things we do to numb ourselves from being present with the world. And in that one of Brené's books, someone said, Well, I was a heroin addict and I've been clean for 25 years, but you mean me playing World of Warcraft 8 hours a day is the same thing? And she's like, uh-huh. And so I, and you know, a lot of maybe my, I don't know, what would you call it, social media profile has got so big or whatever, because I have spent a lot of time on social media answering people's questions. But, you know, looking back now, like, well, was I doing that for the right reason? Or was that just a bit of a numbing behavior? And so it's almost like I'm an alcoholic wine taster. You know, I get paid to taste the wine, but I'm an alcoholic. It's, you know, cause I've really got to, I have to, just monitor myself with that sort of stuff, because I think it would be very easy for me to do it for all the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think partially I've got to this point because of some of those too. So it's just something I have to be careful of. But I do love teaching people. I love sharing ideas. That's what I really like to do. You know, if I've got a gift, I think the gift would be being able to explain things to people in a way that they can understand, where they haven't been able to understand that thing before. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like I lay awake at night trying to think of ways to explain stuff. In the middle of clinic, stuff just comes out of me. I don't know where it's coming from, but it's not like I work on it and do my homework and whatever. I'm full on ad lib, you know, stick me out there in front of a crowd of people, give me a horse, and it stuff just comes out of me. So that I think really that's my one talent that I have. You know, I'm not a terribly talented horse rider. I think I'm quite left brained. You know, ones and zeros, right, wrong, all that sort of stuff. And that's enabled me to probably pay attention enough to notice little things to come up with a process. You know what I mean? But I'm not terribly intuitive. Like the friend of ours that we bought that horse Sherlock off, like he's a, you know, amazing reining trainer, you know, makes the finals of all the major age events all the time. He's hard to learn from because he didn't know what he does. He can just do it. Whereas I think that's the reason I can explain things well is because I'm not talented. So I have to know exactly what I'm doing with the where's, the why, the when, the what, the how's in order for it to work for me. And so that's transferable to other people. If you are just talented and can just do it and just comes out of you, that's hard to explain to other people.
I so relate to that. I don't think I'm very talented either. But I think if you really want something, then you have to study it and you have to understand it and then you have to apply it and then you have to practice it and you study it some more if you really love it, if you want to go after it. So I completely relate to that. So, Warwick, who have been some of the biggest influencers in your life?
You know what? I haven't had that many mentors, and I would say that's partly to do with me not believing in myself. You know, like, you know, I know, you know, back when I was training running horses in the warm up pen and all that sort of stuff, I would, you know, not have much self confidence. I think I tried to, you know, act like I knew more than I did. So I didn't feel confident enough to go up and say, hey, you know, over the years I got better at it, but especially early on, I didn't feel confident enough to go, I have no idea, I'm screwing this thing up here so bad. Can you give me a hand? You know, so I worked for Don Murphy for 3 years and, you know, that was my in, you know, without Don, I wouldn't, you know, without Don, because when I was going home, without Don saying, you know what, you know, if you want to come back, I'll give you a job and you could do this for a living if you want to. Without him saying that, I'd be living in a small house with a white picket fence in Australia somewhere now, I think. And, you know, he was my first introduction to horse training in America, you know. So, you know, I learned a lot from Don. I don't think I was ready to work for Don when I worked for him anyway. You know what I mean? But and another thing is, you know, being a timid sort of a person, and he's a rather imposing figure, he scared the hell out of me for 3 years. So I probably didn't take as much in as if he didn't. He, you know, he didn't scare me. I remember at one point in time, probably in about the second year I was there, I remember Don riding up to me one day and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "For God's sake, just try something. I don't care if it's wrong." Because I got to where I was so afraid of getting in trouble with these horses that I wasn't trying to teach him anything new. I was just riding him around. You know what I mean? And, he said, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" And he says, "Just try something. I don't care. Try, do something. I don't care if you get it wrong." Well, I cared if I got it wrong because I don't like being yelled at, you know. And so then I'd say the mentors, I tell you what, who helped me a lot you know, there's been different people that have helped me quite a bit, but helped me a lot in the reining deal was a friend of mine named Joe Schmidt from Texas. Mm-hmm. And Joe was from Texas. He'd worked for Casey Hinton for many years. And then he moved out here to California to work for Frank Belaya. So Frank Belaya lives not very far from us and owns a Toyota dealership. And he used to be one of the leading owners in the NRHA. And Joe came out here to work for him, and they didn't have a covered arena, and I did. So Joe used to come and ride with me a lot. And Joe really – he was the one that really kind of – Joe will ask anybody any question, and he's the one that really kind of made it clear to me that it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to look stupid, you know. And it also helped me a lot with the reining stuff. And then, you know, I probably had some influence with Joe with the horsemanship side of stuff, the everything leading up to the riding sort of stuff, and maybe some of the young horse stuff. But Joe was a big influence. But then I think probably the biggest influences have been, you know, people like you with that one little conversation we had where you said something about Brené Brown. Because listening to those books led me to the whole, you know, you can't selectively suppress emotions, and that led me to the therapy, which led me to the judgment, that led me to the, you know. So I think that the biggest, you know, if you said who were your mentors, I'm not sure I really had any biggest influences there. It's just little things like on the porch with Don, at your booth at the Horse Expo, when you just casually mentioned Brené Brown, you know. I think those are kind of the moments that are big influences. Cody the Mustang from the Texas Clinic. You know, without him, and I didn't realize how big of an impact it was going to have from him. You know, at the time I didn't know he's not going to bolt for the next 4 years. But haven't lucky enough to have things like that happen. But I'm not a good planner. I've just always been very lucky. And I've got to this point in life by following whatever pops up in front of me. And the saying yes to opportunities that arise. But I've also got this way by avoiding the hard things. And so it's hard because, you know, everything's going great. But when I really do some self-introspection, it's like you've got to start finding some hard things to do because you kind of got here luckily. By when things got hard, you go a different direction and it works out for you. So obviously I'm kind of meant to be doing what I'm doing. Otherwise it wouldn't have popped up here, but I've got to find things that challenge me in way, you know, like people go, because when I do a clinic, I'm in the arena from 8 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. I live to pee. That's it. I don't stop talking all day. And people go, "How do you do that? Like, you must just be able to reach down in the depths of your soul and pull up the energy to do that." No, that is easy for me because I tell you what, it's probably one of the, because I'm in my head a lot, and it's probably one of the times I'm truly present. because I'm not thinking about what I'm going to say in the next 10 seconds. I'm not thinking about what I said in the last 10 seconds. I'm in the moment. Okay. When I'm out of there, my head's full of stuff. But, you know, especially working with a horse, especially a horse that might be half scary, in front of a group of people, and you're explaining to them what you are doing as you are doing it, you can't be 10 seconds behind and you can't be 10 seconds in front. Mm-hmm. And so people go, oh, yeah, it's amazing you can do that. That's not pushing myself outside my comfort zone. That's not the stuff mm-hmm. I need to go, oh, yes, it's hard to mm-hmm. do. It's not hard to do for me. I have to, you know, I don't like being cold, so getting in the ice bath, that's the sort of thing. I hate running, so I've been running lately. Because I hate running.
Yeah. Well, how about being vulnerable and sharing your personal journey? Has that been hard?
Initially, yes. Because all the stuff that I've been sharing is stuff that I used to be ashamed of. And so initially talking about that stuff was quite hard, but I'm good at it now. And it's almost, I don't know if you ever watched the movie Fight Club, where that guy starts going to like AA meetings and NA meetings and all sorts of stuff just to sit there and spill his guts to people. And he becomes addicted to it because it feels good to do it and get, you know, like Brené Brown says, you always think that people are going to judge you poorly, but when you are vulnerable, if you can do it in the right circumstances, you get, yeah, me too. And I think that's a really cool part, to where you do that a lot and you get that me too, and we start to realize we're all more alike than we ever, we ever imagined. I went to a couple of years ago, what was called a men's emotional resilience retreat. It was led by this guy who used to be an Air Force captain, has done a lot of different sorts of work. And there was 8 of us at this retreat for the weekend. One guy was a former UN hostage negotiator. So like he was a bad guy. I mean, a badass, not a bad guy. You know, there was so here's the tough guy. There was a guy that was quite effeminate. He was a filmmaker from Kansas, really artistic, and everything in between those two. And when it all came down to it, everybody had the same fears. Everybody had the same, you know, the first night we started there, it's a 3.5-day thing. And, you know, the first half day we all gather around in this big living room in this cabin up in the mountains. And the guy that leads the whole thing says, okay, what we're going to do, we're going to go around the room, introduce yourself, and then I want you to tell us something that you're ashamed of that you've never told anybody before, and I'll go first, right off the bat. And as the weekend went on, we started to let go more and more and more. And so I think the first round, everybody might have told the thing that was the least shameful thing that they'd never told anybody. But as the weekend went on, people revealed some crazy stuff. But the thing is, when it got down to it, everybody there had the same basic issue, the tough guy, the effeminate filmmaker, and everybody in between. And it's kind of like, we all judge ourselves because whatever, whatever, whatever. But everybody struggles with whatever those things are.
Warwick, I think that your gift to the horse world is your amazing connection with horses and how you've developed that and how you've shared that and your proliferation of videos, and also I think your openness, because we all do feel that way, and it's hard to let down the shields, as Brené would say, and to expose our weaknesses. It's that vulnerability looks good on you but not on me that idea, you know, to show me how scared you are, show me how you've had to be courageous, but I don't want to show my weaknesses. And I think that you being so open about your journey helps all of us in the ways that we want to learn. We want to learn about horses and we want to grow in ourselves. And that's, you know, really horses are the great vehicle that helps us learn about ourselves.
Oh, so. Most certainly. Like I've had people that, you know, I've helped and followed my stuff or whatever, and they say, you know what? I've had such big changes doing this stuff with horses, but it's also changed how I interact with my husband and my kids and my coworkers. And the thing is, they wouldn't make those changes for their husband or for their kids or for their coworkers or for their boss, but they'll do it. If it'll help me get along with my horse, I'll do it. It's almost like, you know, people are passionate about their horses and will basically do anything they can to make that better. And that's probably one of the few places in their life where they will do the hard work in order to make things better.
Yes. And I think one of the things that people always say is that I want to be with my horse because my horse doesn't judge me. Coming back to your judgment conversation that we had. It's great. Well, Warwick, you're a treasure, and I cherish our friendship, and we get to see each other every once in a while, and it's always a delight. And Robin, I've gotten to know her a little bit, and she's a sweetheart, and so
she sure is. She puts up with me.
And I know a lot of people have enjoyed your podcast. How do you feel about podcasting? Do you like that?
You know, the podcast kind of took on a life of its own. Robin's idea, when I decided to do a podcast, Robin's idea was to almost have it like a talkback radio show, like Dr. Laura or something like that, where people would call in and, you know, I'd answer the questions. And then the first two episodes of the podcast I did, the first one was called Changes, and I forget what the second one was, but it was basically almost this conversation that we've had here, how I look at things differently, blah, blah, blah. And then I had a guest on, I think it might've been Jane Pike, actually, our mindset coach in the world of question games. Jane was on there, and she's like you, she's an absolute treasure. And, you know, it was not talking just about horses. It was about personal growth and all sorts of things. And then I had somebody else who went down that same path and somebody else. And I just kept getting these amazing, amazing guests on there that their stories were just amazing. And they were vulnerable about things. And they told people what was really going on. It wasn't just a fluff piece sort of thing. And yeah, then it's just gone on and on from there. So I've just started, actually. The last two podcasts we did were actually question and answer things. I wasn't having people on. I had people email me questions and I answered them, just because we had a lag of trying to being able to organize people and I at the same time to get them on the podcast. It's been pretty amazing. And the whole vibe at clinics since the podcast, I've only done two clinics this year since the podcast started. And the vibe at it was completely different because people come knowing, oh, there's more. This is not just a horse training clinic. There's there's a bit of other stuff there. So, yeah, it's been, I'm enjoying doing it.
So they know you a bit more now since you've been doing the podcast.
Yeah, and they know a bit more about that it's all related. You know, that horses and life is the same thing. And we're going to talk a bit about life and maybe ask some hard questions as well as work with some horses. So,
Well, Warwick, you have your website. That's where people can find all the things that you do and all the resources that you have, right? And where you're going to be.
Yeah. And so I've got a YouTube channel. I've got 300 and something videos on there. We have the podcast, which is called the Journey On Podcast, and it's on all the platforms. I have a Facebook page, a fan page. That's Warwick Schiller Performance Horsemanship. And then I have a private Facebook group that you have to ask to be let into. And it's called Warwick Schiller Performance Horsemanship as well.
Okay. Well, thank you again. Just an honor and a joy and just wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait till we can catch up again.
I know. I told Robin the other day that the next time I'm in California, I'm going to come and see you guys.
Oh, you need to. Please do.
Yes. Yes. Would love that. Okay. Well, until I get to see you next time, Warwick, we'll take care, and thank you again.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think you'll agree that hearing Warwick speak about connection with horses and his life was a treat. and I'm inspired by his curiosity and courage in all things equine and human. Thank you for listening, and until next time, have fun, enjoy your horse, and be kind to yourself.
Thank you for listening to The Barbara Schulte Show. If you have enjoyed this episode, subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram to stay tuned for future episodes.